Resistance to change is something which I see, which is probably one of the biggest challenges. What I would say is to address that issue is engage people early, get their buy-in early. Doesn't mean that you engage every data user who's going to be part of this journey, but all the key stakeholders. It is really important, especially the sponsors, get their buy-in early.
Data Futurology has three exciting conferences coming up in the second half of the year. We have Data Engineering on the 5th of September in Sydney, followed by Advancing AI on the 6th and 7th of September in Sydney. And then October 24th and 25th, we're going to have our Ops World event in Melbourne. Our conferences cover three main pillars: executive perspectives on leadership and strategy in the space, industry use cases and case studies. And then the third one is advancements in the technologies. Come and find out what's happening in the community. Bring your teams along. Get everyone together. It's going to be three great events. Hope to see you there.
I'd like to say a big thank you to our sponsors, Talent Insights. Talent Insights are Australia's leading specialist data recruitment business. With offices in Sydney, Melbourne, and Brisbane, their experts are providing recruitment strategy and building data teams for clients across industries Australia-wide. They provide recruitment solutions for all roles across the data lifecycle, including data engineering, data science, advanced analytics, customer and marketing insights, business intelligence, data product managers, and data governance. They're skilled at finding the best permanent and contract hires for your business needs, as well as statement of work, project focus, data resources. At Talent Insights, relationships matter most. I can say from first-hand experience, Talent Insights are fantastic to work with. Whether you're a business leader within an HR network or a specialist data candidate, Talent Insights should be the first company you turn to for all your data recruitment needs. Find them at talentinsights.com.au.
This is a Measurements Thought Leaders panel, and the title is The Ops Movement. Is it more than hype? And obviously, ops has been a key theme of today, a growing capability in the industry. And for a lot of people, it's new or very new, and others are starting to take steps in this direction. So it's a new capability for us to develop, which is what today is all about. So I'll introduce the moderator, and then he'll take it away with the rest of the panel. So please welcome Andrew Aho. He's the Regional Director for Data Platforms at InterSystems. Please welcome Andrew.
Thank you. Thanks, Felipe. Good afternoon, everybody. Andrew Aho is my name. My pleasure to be here this afternoon and to introduce to you this wonderful panel of experts. Let me bring up, please, Amar Potatoru, who is the Head of Data and Technology at Australian Ethical, Catherine Fowler, who is the Head of Business Transformation at L'Occitane Australia, and Amir James, who is the Head of Data at Resolution Life. Please help me welcome them.
Would you like to sit?
Thank you. So as Felipe said, the topic is all about the ops movement, and is it more than hype? I think we have a good answer to that today, just judging by how many people turned up and all the different sessions that we've been having. But this panel here, I think these individuals know a lot more about this topic, certainly than I do. So great to get their perspectives and experience on this particular topic. So let me start with the first question. How do you define and measure the return on investment of data and analytics initiatives? And in particular, what metrics might you use to demonstrate the business value of these initiatives? Catherine, would you like to take a first pass at this?
Yeah, sure. So for me, I'm always looking for a dollar figure. At its most fundamental level, I'm looking to understand, to start with, what is it costing us to do business this way right now? So then when we put in place an improvement initiative, I can actually prove a dollar value ROI to the people who speak in dollar values. So that includes my executive level, finance, who obviously I need to sign off on project budgets. But it also gives better context to what we would potentially use as an internal project team measure, for example, adoption rate, so that I can prove what that means in real terms to the business. But it also helps me look at those measures, and when they're not quite reaching the target that we've set, I can see where there's potentially a quick win or a greater win in terms of value returned in order to get us to that target.
Excellent. Do you find, because you said you like to tie it to dollars, are they more swung towards sort of expense management or revenue opportunities? Are you able to find those hard savings or revenue opportunities?
Yeah, it really depends on what the initiative actually is. And so I treat every initiative as its own project and work through pretty much the same methodology that I think we've all been seeing time and time again today, particularly defining what we're actually trying to do, looking at how we're currently measuring it, and working from there to see, am I looking at a cost reduction initiative? Am I looking at a revenue generation initiative? A bit of both. And it may also, for a longer project, be dependent on the phase that we're actually able to implement at any one time.
Okay. The other comment you made in there was around adoption rates. Is that relating to how many people are actually taking up the use of the information you might be putting in front of them?
Yes. So, for example, if part of the deliverables for an initiative is reporting, we obviously want to understand how many people are moving to the report that we've just delivered as opposed to whatever the old method of data consumption was. And then say, who is it? What does that improvement mean for them as a group, as part of that adoption? And again, depending who it is, it may actually be a difference between cost reduction and revenue generation. For example, the difference between sales and marketing and their adoption of a report versus someone in, even the exec suite, for example.
Interesting. Analytics on your own analytics. So to say. Amar, I think you've got some interesting experience around this area as well, in particular around the metrics that you might have found have been successful in getting these initiatives off the ground.
Thanks, Andrew. So in my experience, what I've seen is you've got to really align with the business strategy and you've got to measure the metrics that matter for the business. A couple of examples I can give is, when I was working in a retail organization, it is very hard to show the business the value of data and analytics. This is actually going back 20 years ago. So one of the strategic objectives of the organization was, we want to free up $500 million. How can we achieve that? So we looked at various things, how can we free up $500 million? And one of the things was around getting better at inventory management. So if you think about the retailers, they have 15, 20 distribution centers, they have lots of stock sitting in there. So if you optimize your logistics, if you optimize your supply chain, and if you optimize your stock management, then you can actually bring that down and then free up the capital. So we had to look at a number of things to achieve that goal of capital, freeing up the $500 million. And that required a lot of things, changing within the organization around change management, working with the supermarkets, working with the area coordinators, a whole bunch of people. But then in the end, building that analytical models so that we can actually reduce the stock within the warehouses, which then allowed the company to go and invest in the other markets.
Interesting. And I think that highlights some perhaps the difference between hard measures and soft measures as well, right? You're really talking about a tangible 300 to 500 million that you could actually save and deliver it.
Yeah, so you ought to always look at the top line and bottom line as well. It's just not always about the top line. It's also about the bottom line as well. Bringing the operational efficiencies. The last thing we want to do is, when the customer is coming into the store, the stock is not on the shelf. Yes, you have achieved your $500 million target, but then if you are creating a bad experience with the customer when they're walking in, well, they don't have the stock on the shelf. So got to look at all of the aspects as well.
Fantastic. Thank you. And Amir, I just heard part of your presentation before. Fascinating. I imagine you've done quite a bit of work in this area in terms of justification to be able to get to that kind of 15% of your total staff are focused in this area. What are some of your secrets, if you don't mind?
So I think the business case doesn't really change it. It's either down to, you know, cost reduction, cost avoidance, or revenue generation, and you've got to spell it out to the executives in terms of dollars. I talked about the platform earlier. The platform is all about the business functions as well. I think a key way of measuring it is how you optimize those functions, those processes. I know there's tools now, such as process optimization tools, that are looking at process process re-engineering to see how many other steps the business is actually following. So if you've got a process that's defined top-down and you've got 20 or 30 steps in it, but you get the data to support that or look at that process, you may find that 15 or half of those steps are skipped. And then you question whether there's any, what the value is then of optimizing that process and turning that into a dollar value. And that's probably an easier business case for the execs to buy into.
So you're saying you really do have to be able to sell the big picture as well as get into the detail and show where these savings are going to come from, if they're not, in fact, revenue generation opportunities as well.
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, you get a top-down approach to budgets. Management execs will come every year with a top-down approach of the numbers they want to achieve. And then the bottom-up is how you actually make that work. What savings can you make? How can you use data to optimize, AI to optimize? And then you have to round it up to a number. I think what I would love to get there is, and I know that in industry, data quality is one of the big problems that's been there for years, and it's still not going away. And I think data quality is a number I wish I could turn every percentage data quality into a dollar value and convince execs how important it is to have good data quality. I think it's on average $15 million a year, I think, it costs organization.
Yeah, I've certainly heard a range of different figures as to what it costs in different industries, but having kind of a number that come down to and demonstrate we're improving in this area by how much would be a fascinating thing to do. I might just remind the audience, we do have the Slido, so if you'd like to ask questions as we go along, please do to ask them via Slido, and I'll try and get them answered. So question number two, let's go back to you, Amar. And so this one is, as more organizations adopt ops processes and methodologies, what are some of the challenges that people might anticipate that will arise, and how can you address them and work through them?
It's a really good question, Andrew. Before I talk about the kind of the obstacles, I just want to spend, you know, maybe a couple of minutes on ops process itself and the methodologies. If you look at the ops process, you know, we've got to really take into account the whole data lifecycle from create, acquire, store, use, retain, destruct. Over the last 20 years, a lot has been done in this space to share the data, data partnerships. You know, we saw data products earlier, and it comes with a lot of accountability around regulatory requirements, compliance, privacy. Especially if you're operating in the BFS sector, there's a lot of regulatory requirements. So that's on the off side. And if you come to the methodologies, a lot has evolved again, you know, traditional waterfall to agile to hyper agile to what Amir mentioned earlier around, you know, the 90-day cycle. So there's a lot happened in that space as well. Now, coming to the obstacle side of things is, there is probably, I would say, you know, 3 to 4 areas, which I see as a big ones. One is around the resistance for change. You know, with this change, you know, with these new methodologies and all of that, people had to adapt and learn a whole heap of new things. As we all know, we went from mainframe to multi-cloud. You know, we went from mainframe on to on-premises, Hive and Peak and Hadoop and all of those things. Then we went to the Synapse or Redshift, and now we're going into Snowflake and the Databricks and so forth. So people really didn't have time to actually learn the new kit. So resistance to change is something which I see, which is probably one of the biggest challenges. What I would say is to address that issue is engage people early, get their buy-in early. Doesn't mean that you engage every data user who's going to be part of this journey, but all the key stakeholders, it is really important, especially the sponsors, get their buy-in early. The second side, of, I would say, is the integration. As I said, you know, we went from mainframe to the SaaS applications now, on-premises, private cloud, and all of that. So the integration is becoming even more challenging. You know, traditionally, when you build things on-premise, you have your control on your applications. Now with SaaS applications, which is a lot more adoption, you can't really plug into their databases. So you have to have a connector. Now, you know, you need so many tools out there. That's kind of a bit of a challenge as well. So I would say the integration is a bit of a challenge. And people have lots of choices. There's too many silver bullets out there to solve that kind of a problem. So I would say, you know, don't choose too many platforms. I know companies having 5 or 6 different integration platforms. I would say just choose one or two to solve the key problems and then just stick to it. It may not solve all of your problems, but just stick to one or two platforms. The third one I would say is the talent. As I said, you know, we have evolved so much. You know, the data scientists and the data teams are now taking on a lot more accountability. If you look at traditionally what happened 15, 20 years ago, you used to have a DBA, you used to have a BA, you used to have a testing team, infrastructure team. You know, they used to do all their own different things which they needed to do to achieve the business outcome. But now we got this data scientist or a data engineer, call them a super engineer, because they got all the keys to the kingdom and then they can do anything they want. But at the same time, you know, they have to start learning all these new skills. So I would say, you know, the talent is one of the challenges as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ma, thank you. There's a lot to unpack in that.
Yeah.
I think there certainly are no silver bullets. And if you can find ways to standardize, it's a bit of the Pareto 80-20 rule, right? You're going to get 80% of what you need. And, you know, the 20% you can deal with in other ways at a different time. But I wanted to come back to you, in terms of the challenges and things you can anticipate. Now, we constantly hear at Ender Systems that, you know, change management is a big issue with all of these kinds of programs. So maybe, Amir, if you had a few thoughts on how you've tried to, I think you said communicate early, but other things that you've tried to do to help with the change challenge.
I think it's selling the vision, selling the art of the possible is key to the change and getting exec buy-in. If you can show to them and prove to them in increments that you get value from how you get value from data, then you get them their buy-in a lot earlier, and they'll buy into that change. Whereas I still think that execs somewhat think that technologists will be technologists and will want to play with tools, and they will, you know, get a constant, oh, we need this next tool, the next best thing that comes along. They sort of half think, oh no, it's the latest tool that technology need to play with. Whereas if you make it everything real for them in terms of business outcomes and for that change, I think you get a lot more buy-in that way.
Yep, totally agree. And Catherine, I wanted to get your opinion because I've heard it a few times today around things, new technologies, new silver bullets like ChatGPT and other things. So what do you see as being the challenges and the impact of the introduction of these new technologies in business?
Yeah, for me, it's what I call shiny tool syndrome. So the exec team learn about tools such as ChatGPT and, oh, it's going to be wonderful. We absolutely need to be on that without consideration of, for example, what that means in terms of value and change management, as we've already mentioned. So I think, as more of these tools and particularly more machine learning and AI tools come to market and get the hype as well within the general public, and that I think is a ChatGPT is a particular example of that, then quite often you get pressure from higher and higher up to implement these tools regardless of whether there's a business case and a clear strategic direction for the implementation of the tool.
Yep, it's shiny tool syndrome. I like that. It's something that we can play with and not quite clear on how it's going to help. I think that can be the reality with a lot of these advanced new technologies. It's quite hard to understand just how hard it's going to be, how much it's going to deliver on what its promise is. And that's probably a great segue to that question there. So if anyone wants to jump in and tackle that. But speaking of hype, what do you think is currently overhyped in the data space and why?
Well, for me, I think ChatGPT and similar tools are in that. For me, particularly when the general public is really hyping a technology, I become very, very wary from a business perspective, because when you are looking at cost benefit of implementing a particular tool, you really need to, obviously, in a business space, be mindful much more so than as a personal user of things like data security. And especially if you are bound by requirements such as GDPR. And so that kind of level of hype can blind people within a business perspective. But also, just because there's hype for the general public does not mean that that translates to business use cases and tangible business use cases as well. So I think with a tool like, for example, ChatGPT, the hype within a business context is definitely an overhype as I see it at the moment, because there is far more risk in using it within a business context than there is value payoff at the moment, I believe.
Yeah, I think it's a real, the hype is absolutely amazing around ChatGPT, but just like any kind of advanced technology, it's so accessible, right? You can just jump on and ask questions, but people might not realize that there's no privacy associated with that tooling at the moment. How do you use it sensibly in a business context without exposing the business to serious risks? If you can imagine patient or GDPR or financial data ending up at the wrong place. So any other hyped products, Amar or Amir?
So in general, I think the AI hype has been there for a couple of years now, and especially during COVID, there's a lot of hype in the AI space. I interact with, my previous roles, even my current role, I interact with the board members and the executive team. There is always talk about, Amar, what are we doing about AI? And my feedback is always, let's get our basics right first before we talk about AI. So I think in general that AI hype is still there.
Yeah,
it's achievable. Anything is achievable. But I think, having the right foundations, laying, using them first and then moving into the next phase of AI is what I would say. As Catherine said, there is a lot of talk about ChatGPT.
Yeah.
I get asked, when can we get to that level? Well, we're not there yet.
Yeah.
So there is definitely a lot of hype.
And I think if you come back to the business problem and then work on solving that first, it might turn out that a simple dashboard or a report without any machine learning, simple analytics might actually just solve the issue at hand. Let's move on. I've just lost my screen here, but I think there was a question there around challenges associated with the implementation of ops. And we have a similar sort of question here around what are some of the common pitfalls to avoid when we are implementing and then measuring the impact of data and analytics initiatives in an organization. So what are some of the things that we can do to ensure we are looking at the right risks and then the right metrics to be drawing accurate conclusions on if they're the right things for our business and successful in our organizations? And I think we might start with Catherine again on that one, please.
In my experience, trying to do too much all at one time, and especially when maturity within the organization is very, very young, keeping focused, in my experience, is the best way to keep that alignment with strategic direction, which is then how you can very easily prove ROI on a very specific piece and start to gain trust and earn that buy-in that you need to be be able to ramp up operations, particularly because quite a number of organizations start with a very small team when they're very early on in terms of maturity. And that's a very difficult conversation to have. Obviously, we need more people to get to the goal of, you know, implementing AI and solutions such as that. But if you can't prove from the beginning with that tangible return on investment that what your small team is capable of doing, you won't reach that level of resourcing that you need to ultimately prove success at a much larger scale.
Yeah, very interesting. So yeah, that resonates really well with me. I think this idea of being able to build the scale in the team and keeping the focus based on your successes. Again, if you're selling the vision and getting those resources from the executives, then you need to be able to demonstrate this sort of progress. I'm not sure if this was this question was asked when you were talking, because it did go blank for a minute, but it seems to be related. So then how do we do experiments and understand potential if we're kind of focused and trying to be rigid in what we're doing? How do you address that need to do both experimentation as well as keeping focused?
So I would not be considering experiments and trying to understand potential, whether from a program or a tool perspective, in any kind of early stage analytics, data analytics program. That is something that for me, you need to have already got that buy-in. You need to have proven the worth of the work that's being done to be able to actually say to the relevant people, all right, give us space, give us resourcing, etc., to be able to look at what could we do in order to add additional steps to reach the goal that we have in our minds as our vision compared to where we are right now.
Interesting. Yeah. So thank you very much. I think that's certainly in the early stages, that's really important. And Amar, I think you've got some experience in this area as well. What's your view?
Yeah. So around the experiments and understanding potential. So obviously, you know, the data people are very data savvy. You know, they want to try and solve all the problems. So one of the things which I always said to my teams and myself is aligning with the business strategy. Yes, there are hundreds of problems which we can solve. You know, we all can have ambitious goals, but, you know, what is the actual business problem which we are trying to solve? Especially in the data science space, it's, you know, it's always about hypothesis testing, experimentation, you know, trying new things. And then, you know, scientists get really disappointed when, you know, when the executives are not listening. But then making sure that, you know, aligning with the business goals, for example, if I take insurance, you know, how do we reduce our claims? You know, claims ratio, you know, we need to look at ratio. If I look at real estate, you know, how do we get better at our valuation? So anything you are doing, experimenting, how is that helping the business? And then allow them to actually try things at the same time as well, but then making sure that you're aligned with the business goals.
So perhaps in a bit more of a mature you know, data organization, you've built the credibility, you've got the resources, and then you're encouraging a portion, whether it's 20% time or some other factor. I mean, is that basically how you approach it?
Yeah, so that is something, yeah. So in larger organizations, yes, that is possible. Yeah. And yes, you know, that's something which I have kind of encouraged my team members. So I'll give you an example. So this is going back to my when I was working for a pure play data analytics company. Obviously, company had a lot of their own goals, but one of the team members came up with an idea. Well, we can actually look at all these unstructured data, which we can capture through councils and all the other data sources, and then combine that with our structured data, and then we can actually look at the concentration risk. It's a brilliant idea, and it actually turned out to be a multi-million dollar product. So encouraging them then trying new things is also really critical as well.
Fantastic. Thank you. Can I step back a half step? Amir, I think this is one for you. Is the second question, how do you estimate the value of change in order to get the buy-in? And what's the what's the value of taking the time to implement a new testing suite? Any sort of quick thoughts on how you might maybe not specifically the testing suite, but how you go about getting that next level of detail.
How can you measure it? What I wanted to touch upon earlier was, I think we've probably all heard of a cost to serve. If we can put a dollar value to data quality, for example, for each percentage point, then I'm sure you'd get buy-in straight away for a data quality suite. I think for a testing suite, if you could put that into reality, is how many data pipelines get released to production that aren't properly tested? And what is the dollar cost of the errors that come out of those pipelines? What is the impact to the business because the data is not right? They're not making the right decisions. Can you then roll that back up into a dollar value from having a proper testing suite, automated, pre-configured, that you can just roll with every release that you have?
Yep. And always bringing it back to, I think is, I think the whole panel has said, bringing it back to the business. What's the revenue opportunity, the cost to avoid, or the expense that can be saved as a result of that?
Yeah.
Okay, we're sort of getting into the last few minutes here. So let's shift gears to looking forwards. What new developments or trends do you think will emerge in this space over the next 5 to 10 years? And Amir, how do you think organizations should start preparing?
I think one of the bigger changes, it's been around for a while, but it may really gather traction, is the merge of business and IT. The functional teams and the IT teams, data teams, all merging into one, or everybody working a lot closer together. And I see it as part of the enterprise agile organization I'm at now, is that everybody has to work as a team. I'm not allowed to be called a tech team anymore or a data team. The business isn't allowed to be called a business team. They're the functional team. We're all the business. So when I speak to my execs, you know, we're all the business, and I get told off for saying the word business. I'm still trying to rewire my brain from 25, 30 years of calling business the business. And something hit me today, actually. It was just at the lunchtime with this merge of IT and the business. We're in a data ops conference, yet I met a banker at the tables at lunchtime. So that to me just confirms that the business side, the bankers are interested in how we do data ops. They want to know what's the secret behind it all. What do these tech guys know that I don't know? How can I find out how to do it easier, smarter, quicker, so we can all benefit? So there's a real interest there from the business side to the, I guess, black box many, many times of what we do in the data space and tech space. And we very much in the tech and data space want to know how we can benefit the business. So it's going to be a merge, I think.
Yeah, fascinating. I think that's a really interesting future, and you're living a lot of this right now. So that's very interesting. Catherine, what do you see looking forward the next 5 to 10 years?
I agree actually with Amir, and particularly from a talent perspective. If we consider how technically savvy the kind of younger generations particularly are now, that is a very different type of talent coming in to a business as compared to 20 and definitely 30, 40 years ago. And I think we're going to see, whether through sort of tertiary education or other education avenues, a shift as well in the way that we're developing the talent to support that idea that the business is the business. We all work together. There is not a silo of IT within the business.
What sort of challenges do you think we'll face along that journey as well?
That's a really good question, because I think one of the key challenges is getting established credentials that are relevant, etc. Universities definitely have tried this before, and I know because that was the bachelor's program that I went through, and it lasted less than 10 years, 20 years ago. That was way ahead of its time, but also a lot of what we covered would not be as relevant now. And so what credentials would you want a person to have moving into a space that looks like this? What do they need to be able to do Even if they're sitting on a team that functionally is what we maybe used to refer to as data or IT or whatever, if we are considering this idea of one unit, what do we need to do differently within, for example, an IT degree, an info systems degree, or a comp engineering degree? And the same, obviously, from a business side. What do we need to do differently? What do we need this talent to do? And what do we need to do to nurture that and make sure we're serving what this new world looks like?
Yeah, truly a big, big challenge and therefore opportunity around credentials and education. So, Amar, you get the chance to finish the thoughts from the panel. What is it that you're looking forward to most in the next 5 to 10 years in this space?
So I think, the evolution is happening in the space of cloud. I think the companies are just getting started moving things into the cloud. In the BFS space especially, it's been a difficult journey to comply with regulatory frameworks and the compliance and Privacy Act and all of those things. So I think I'm looking forward for more adoption in that cloud space, which also brings a bit of a challenge, as I mentioned before, is around the integration side of things. So I would say, looking forward for the adoption, having all the right frameworks, and I hope we don't really get more shiny tools, as Catherine said earlier, because we have had a big evolution in the AI space and the data cloud space. And I hope, we take a pause with Snowflake and Databricks, and then we don't really get another platform as such. So that's what I'm looking forward for, Andrew.
Fantastic.
One thing I would also add, Andrew, is apart from these things, I think one of the things which I'm really keen is don't overlook your data quality. I know today's all about ops process, but if you don't have the right data quality framework, I know the governance is seen as not a great thing in organizations. So one of the things which I implemented for a large insurance company is something called data governance stage gate. So essentially throughout the life cycle, of the project has to go through that data governance stage gate. So I would say implement that kind of a methodology, which a lean framework, cover all your must data, classification, data quality and whatnot, that will then lead you to success. So basically, avoid any pitfalls which you're going to face down the track.
Having a really strong foundation.
Correct.
And I heard that recently, data governance in general can be frowned upon, but someone said it's like a Formula One car. The only thing that lets that Formula One car go that fast is its brakes, right? So just a different perspective. But thank you all very much. I thought this was very interesting. Amar, Catherine, Amir, thanks again. Back to you, Felipe.
That brings this episode to conclusion. Thank you so much for listening. Please find us on datafuturology.com or on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, or Instagram as datafuturology. Also go to datafuturology.com/podcast to find the show notes for this and any other episodes. If you like this episode, it would mean a lot to us if you could leave us a review wherever you listen to our podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode and that it was helpful and valuable for you. Thanks again, and see you next time.